Rough little tape. Today is January 25th, 1989, and we're here to interview Claude Verdine and his son, Bob Verdine, on a subject that is going to be quite current in the next year or so, and that is Coast Guard and Coast Guard festivals. And if anybody knows the history of them, you two fellas do. So we'll just gab for a while and hope that we can disclose some good history. So I'll sit back and listen to you two guys.
Dave, one of the interesting things to me as I grew up, of course, I listened to Dad and to others talk about the festival and about commercial fishing, which, of course, our family was involved in, and we have to recognize that our involvement in the festival comes as a result of being commercial fishermen and being on the lakes and on the rivers and having high regard for Coast Guard and for its predecessor, the U.S. Life Saving Service. In fact, there's a close tie-in between the two. In the early days when the U.S. Life Saving Service had just pulling boats, they obviously could not go out and effect a rescue of anything of any size. And so they had to call on other equipment, and the other equipment were tugs like the H.J. Dornbos and the C.J. Boss that were owned by the Verdine family. They would be captained by Captain William Verdine, Dad's uncle, and his father, Caleb Verdine.
What year are we talking about there?
1898 is the date that the charcoal iron-hulled C.J. Boss was built by Johnson Boiler. Our last contact with that boat was in the 50s, still under steam power, operating in South America on the Amazon River, booming logs.
I'll be darned, I didn't know that.
Pretty well-built tug.
Yeah.
You know, charcoal iron hull. There's a history in that, too. You'd have to go to Fayette, Michigan to find out.
Yeah, I've been there.
To know about the charcoal iron.
Uh-huh.
In 1901, the Verdines had another tug built, the H.J. Dornbos, named after, of course, a prominent local businessman and working in the fishing industry. And what brings all of this out right now is that we've just received a letter from the state of New York telling us about this tug, renamed the Urger, and retired in 86, but still operable.
Hmm.
I'm getting ahead of myself. Let's come back to that. We talked about the fact that the Coast Guard couldn't affect certain types of rescue, so they had to call on the commercial fishermen. And so here is an example, and this comes out of a day book that my grandfather, Caleb Verdine, kept.
Yeah, that's a bit of history right there.
And, this is loaded. And here's a picture of the two tugs, the Boss and the Dornbos. We believe the Boss is the one in the foreground, the Dornbos in the background.
I thought you'd misspoken when you said the Boss the first time, but there was.
C.J. Boss.
C.J. Boss, yeah.
Yeah.
And that was named after William Verdine's father-in-law.
Oh.
Celery cable.
Over on someplace in town here?
Yeah.
Over on, where am I thinking, Madison or Ferry?
I have no idea where farm was.
But here's a story, and this is one documentation of the connection between the Life Saving Service or Coast Guard and the fishermen, and it's a story about the rescue of the Latham, and I could go on and read this, but that's not necessary. The Latham basically left the harbor with a scow laden with stone for Sturgeon Bay, Wisconsin, for the government pier. It discharged its cargo and headed back, bound for Muskegon. Out of port, she lost her rudder, and so simultaneously, the Grand Haven life-saving crew put out, and so did the Dornbos. The Dornbos was unable to pass a line, and so, let's see, it says here, and so at last, and with great exhibition of courage and skill, the lifesavers carried the line from the Dornbos to the Latham. And then the Dornbos would pull the Latham in and the pulling boat and would come in by hand power. And Dad comments, he said that what isn't in the article, of course, is that they hit the end of the pier when they came in.
Who did the pulling boat?
Yeah.
Did they really?
Yeah.
That's a seizure, really.
There is some. There is a copy of that article for you.
I'll give you a
little information. Here is...
What's the date on this?
Well, I can't find the date on it. And I'm sorry about that.
They didn't put dates on it.
They sure didn't.
No, it's just too bad.
Yeah.
But looking further into the day book, we've got a couple of other pictures. And again, I'm getting off into an area that maybe you hadn't intended to, but...
Well, no, it all ties in because this is the history of the Coast Guard, as you say.
Yes, it's the history of the Coast Guard, and it's also the history of our involvement. Because these people became, you know, known to each other.
Uh-huh.
And we'll come to that, I suppose, a little later. This is
now, was that true up and down the lake, you suppose?
Yes. You see, the Coast Guard stations were not open year-round.
Now, we only had the one over on that side of the river, didn't we?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But there was certainly no reason to have men on the payroll when all they had was pulley boats. And when the lake would freeze over, the sailing vessels that carried most of the cargo couldn't sail. So they kept a skeleton crew, and the part-time Coast Guardmen who were there during the summer months were turned loose, and most of them were commercial fishermen. Now, the Fisher family, as an example, who lived right on the bend out here, there was Bill Fisher, who became a full-fledged Coast Guardsman and retired after many years of service. His brother, Andrew, also became a full-fledged Coast Guardsman. Both of them were officers in charge of various stations. And the three brothers, Bram and I don't know, we call him Dovey, I don't know what his real name was.
Well, Bram was Abraham.
Yeah,
but what was Dovey? That's
I can't think. And one other, those three brothers became full-fledged commercial fishermen 12 months out of the year. So there was a family of five brothers who lived out here on the bend, and two of them became full-time Coast Guardsmen, and three of them became full-time commercial fishermen.
Now, when you say the bend, you're talking about past the American Legion.
Yeah, past the American Legion. In fact, the house is still there. The their house.
Right across from the fisherman parking lot, then.
But didn't the road pretty much end there?
Yeah, well, it pretty much road. There was no road.
Okay.
They walked.
Oh, did they really?
Sure, and there was a float bridge in there for the government pond, and groceries and things like that were delivered with a horse and wagon, and if they had anything to move, that's the way it went, but there was no road there.
How'd you like to live out there in the wintertime?
Yeah, well, that'd be tough, yeah. And the float bridge, that's interesting that you're talking about the government pond.
Government pond had a float bridge in there.
Now, how did they dismantle that to get the boats went in and out of there, or didn't they?
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, but on rare occasions. Uh-huh. I mean, it was not a daily affair. Mm-hmm. It might have been a spring and fall episode.
Yeah. Uh-huh. But what was the pond ever built for, or wasn't it quite as formidable as it is now? Or what are we talking about, the concrete that is there today? Was there
the wooden pier was built, and obviously was built in a straight line, and it created the pond.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And
not unlike the North Shore Marina was a natural cove. It was called the Cove.
Oh, yes.
Okay, yeah. So in my early days of being across the river, the North Shore Marina wasn't there. They created that by putting in breakwaters.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That was a great place to swim. It had a very sloping beach in the cove. And
the river water was clean in those days.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. And the cottage that's up behind the North Shore Marina was down on the shoreline.
That was Govey Van Zandvoort's cottage.
There, you have to look, but there's a little cottage up behind there.
Now say that again. The cottage where?
Behind the North Shore Marina.
Oh, yeah, of course. I know which one you're talking about.
Brown.
Yes, right. Sure. Mm-hmm. I know which one you're talking about.
Anyway, let me get
back to the boat.
Back for a second, because this history, the connection between the Coast Guard and the commercial fishermen is something that I guess I'm interested in at this point.
Oh, sure.
So we receive a letter dated January 10th, 89, from a Thomas Prindle, Waterways Maintenance Division of the State of New York.
Just last week.
Last week. And he says, I'm seeking historical documentation on the Urger, N-E-E, H.J. Dornbos. And he says he knows that it was belonged to the Verdine family, and he knows when it was built. He has quite a bit of historical background on it.
Well, I thought you had contacted him.
No, we didn't know where the boat was.
We didn't know where it was.
Isn't that a coincidence?
Well, they refer to the Empire State's Navy. Okay, and they sent this little booklet. And in the booklet, the Urger is shown, and this is only a few pages, the Urger is shown in two pictures.
Is it pretty much as it was?
Well, yeah.
Is this it right here?
That's the Dornbos.
Okay,
that's the Dornbos.
Uh-huh.
And here she is in 1930. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Not really a whole lot different.
No.
Okay. And here she is today.
Oh, good heavens.
Not really a whole lot different.
Raised it some, maybe.
He tells me over the phone that he thinks that the pilot house, look at it, was picked off to remove the steam power in 1948. She was still steam in 48, and was moved forward. It looks like the same. It still answers to bells. There's no direct hookup. The guy in the pilot house does not run the diesel engine in it. It answers to bells yet, and he said that the interior of the pilot house, he thinks, is original.
Isn't that something?
Well, the hull is original.
That's great.
Okay. Anyway, they want to know what its original history was, so we're going to research that out and give that to them. And here in the day book, again, we found, this is a story written about the boss and the Dornbos. There's the Dornbos.
Mm-hmm.
And it talks about it. And I love some of the wording in this thing.
Do we have a date on this? I bet we do there.
Well, isn't that interesting?
Here.
Oh, yes.
It's 21 and there's no year.
Isn't that
too bad?
Crazy.
Isn't that crazy?
But we could pinpoint this in that the tug left our family's possession in 22, I think.
That looks like 20s, just the dress.
Yeah.
Or even the teams, it could be.
But here it talks about Captain Caleb Verdine himself took the wheel of the Dornbos as he turned
now,
to
Caleb
reply
is,
his father.
That's your dad.
My grandfather, okay. As he turned to reply in monosyllables to the questions of his guests, they had ample opportunity to study him. They saw such a man as one almost invariably sees among those who wrest a living from the elements. And on and on.
Wow. It's pretty poetic, isn't it?
It's very poetic. It's beautiful, beautifully
written.
This
is not a newspaper article, or is it?
No, it's a magazine.
And it's, so there's more information, and there is this.
Isn't that something? Now.
Now, the thing is, to get to the punchline.
Yes.
They are willing to bring that boat back here for the 200th.
Isn't that
because of its tie-in
with the Coast Guard?
With the Coast Guard.
The Empire State's Navy, New York City, or New York State.
Sure.
And this man says, after he got the information and we talked about its early history, the fact that we could show that it had been involved in rescues with the Coast Guard.
Oh, boy.
He said, my goodness, that's interesting. And I said, what would you think about bringing it here? As New York State's salute to the Coast Guard, and he says, consider it done.
Isn't that great?
Well, because they are going to turn it into a floating museum.
Uh-huh.
And he says, what an opportunity. You know, they could obviously start out and they could make several ports on their way.
Well, it could be a goodwill tour
sure.
Along the way. You know, that's...
And they would be promoting the history of the canal system in New York.
Yes.
Which is their interest.
Now, as a matter of fact, they're having...
The interesting thing is that there are many people in Grand Haven who will remember the Urger, which now has the name Urger.
Urger, yes.
Because... After the Verdine sold it, it went to Michigan City as a commercial fishing vessel.
Mm-hmm.
And it returned as a towing tug and operated out of Grand Haven. And I don't know whether it was Tom Johnson Gravel Company or the Construction Aggregates, because we haven't had a chance to check it out.
Mm-hmm.
But it was operated by one of those companies out of Grand Haven as the Urger.
Oh, so it hasn't changed its name.
A number of years.
So it held its name after it changed from Dornbos to Urger.
And came back to Grand Haven.
Isn't that something?
So yeah.
Here is a picture, just for a moment, Caleb and William.
Uh-huh. So now, William would be your uncle.
Yeah, that was Dr. John's father, Dr. John Verdine.
Oh, yes. Of course, sure. Yeah.
So I suppose that, you know, this is probably enough time spent on this part of the subject, but I've always been very fascinated with this tie-in, and then you begin to get the feel of how the festival began to develop. The commercial fishermen were invited, a number of them, particularly those who were readily available, and
very few attended.
Yeah,
because they were fishing.
Yeah,
uh-huh. but they had the courtesy of an invitation to go to the picnic.
So there's they and a few other citizens in the community invited to the picnic, and then the pulling boat races that began to develop, which is documented pretty much in these two pages, which I can make copies for you.
Yeah, I would like these.
Then, this is the impetus, in my opinion, for the start of the festival.
I think you're probably right, at least. Now, you go, when was your dad fishing on the lakes? Back in, before the turn of the century, would it have been, or not?
No, he was the youngest of the family, so he probably started to fish in 1906 or 1907.
Oh, wait. If the H.J. Dornbos was built in 01,
yeah, he had he took over the boss when Uncle Will took over
and
the door.
And by that time, he would have had to have his captain's license.
Yeah, 1902.
Yeah.
1902.
So, you know, he might have been fishing before 1900, certainly as a hand.
Yeah.
Maybe not as a captain.
Uh-huh. Because you show here in the history you wrote, 79, so
well,
it wasn't long.
The Coast Guard.
Yeah.
Beginning.
Right, yeah. I know it, but I'm just thinking the tie. Your family was almost there at the beginning of this tie-in that you're talking about.
Family tie-in came after the two new boats were built, and there was a need for strength when it came to making rescues.
Mm-hmm.
And.
Rather than going out taking men off of a ship and letting it go, I guess, because you certainly never pulled a boat in with a pulling boat, you made rescue.
Sure.
You now have the power and the potential to bring the ship into port, save it.
I can remember as a kid, 8-9 years old, of going to church on a Sunday morning and motioning to get my dad out of the choir to respond to something.
That was it, right?
Didn't even have telephone, you know.
Uh-huh.
And the other thing is, I've heard them at night to come to the house and rap on the door, but this was in connection with turning the sidewheelers around at the Goodrich dock. If there was a beam wind, they couldn't get away from the dock. And they would call one of the tugs to pull them away from the dock and get them out
into the channel
so they could
begin to move. Yeah. Yeah, those were, they called the black boats?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And did they go all the way to Chicago?
Oh, sure, and Milwaukee.
Uh-huh. Sidewheel.
They could go like hell, you know, when
yeah.
they once got out, but they couldn't get away from the dock. They were helpless with a beam wind.
You know, you would think that, you know, they would have the control of one wheel going one direction and one the other, but they couldn't. Those wheels were directly connected. You know,
yeah.
they had to both go forward or both go backwards.
Oh, there was no way to...
No way.
No, you steered by the rudder.
I'll be there. That is crazy.
The other, and this is going back again, but the guy says that on the Dornbos, he thinks the original rudder and wheel is still on it.
Yeah, I wonder if any of those parts were made in Grand Haven.
Yank engine. Yeah.
Oh, you're okay.
Yeah.
I was going to ask if there was still a, because there were Yank engines were used in those things.
They actually identified its origin because the a number of parts on the boat have Johnson boiler 1901 stamped into them.
Oh, yeah.
Chocks and what do you have? Bollards and things like that that are on the boat. They're still there.
Somebody did some detective work to track that.
Yeah.
Well, now, getting back to we've got the Coast Guard established with Grand Haven, the ties. Now, where did the festival all fit together? How did
it grew out of that.
That 1915 you show here. Revenue, well, wait a minute.
No. 1937.
But there was more to it. Let's see now.
You've got to get to Mayor Cook's...
But now wait a minute here. First of all, we're talking about the revenue cutter service.
Yep.
Okay.
That was 1798.
Life-saving stations in the 10th District assembled in Grand Haven for their annual briefings and exchange of ideas.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know, can we establish when those started? When those exchanges started?
I'll bet 1915.
I don't know.
Uh-huh.
I don't know
how
you can establish it.
Okay, but now keep in mind that in those days there were three districts on the Great Lakes instead of one. There was the 10th out of Grand Haven, the 9th out of Buffalo, New York, and the 11th out of Green Bay, Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. When they had their opportunities to get together, then they began challenging each other to pulling boat races.
That was the reason.
Okay. Now there was some activity in the harbor that anybody could see. And don't you suppose that, this is the impetus again for, well, let's have some kind of a celebration around this. Let's get more people involved.
Mm-hmm. It certainly seemed logical.
You see, then each district, the 9th and the 11th, would train a picked crew and send them over here and compete in pulling boat races and breeches buoy against the pick crew of the 10th District.
Now, can you remember any of that?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Sure, but I can't put a date on it.
Yeah. We're talking about the 20s, though, perhaps. Definitely the 20s. No?
Well, definitely the early 30s.
Oh, okay.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And they had breeches buoy and capsize. That was fun. Roll the boats over. And I got pictures of that.
Uh-huh.
And the pulling boat races. Mm-hmm. And the last pulling boat races, they took two men to the hospital.
Fatigue. Yeah.
And a couple, they laid them on the lawn at the Coast Guard station, and it was a question, do they have to go too, or are we going to pump some air into them?
Yeah, I tell you, we had two of those here in 76. Verplank had gotten a hold of them. I've forgotten where. Somewhere in this area. And we had races, and you're absolutely right. Those things are bears to haul around.
Mm-hmm. And they had pulling boat races, and they started at the Coast Guard station, and they ended at the shipyard where the Barth and those relics were.
Yeah.
That was the course.
Tell me this. You just made me realize there is a film of our centennial parade, which went up the street this way, and it's August 10th, 1934. Now it looks as though they're having pulling boat races in that. They're coming off the Escanaba. It looks as though perhaps there was a connection between some sort of a Coast Guard celebration and our centennial, or were the two? This was before the festival began.
It was probably one of the features of the centennial.
And if it wasn't at the time of one of the annual meetings, it could conceivably have just been the local pulling team.
Yeah. It only showed one boat.
Yeah.
I don't know who they were competing against. But,
may have just been demonstrations. Yeah.
But you show here in this book that you authored, Richard Cook says the second consecutive year in Grand Haven. And this is printed 38, so you can pretty well pinpoint 37 as the year that it all
officially.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And what were they like back then? Can you remember?
Yeah. In fact, I have the newspaper that has the full page program of all the events for the Water Fete, F-E-T-E.
Uh-huh.
That's what it was called.
So it really did center around the water back then.
Oh, yeah.
The parade was not the big deal.
No.
Yeah.
Are you sure there was even a parade the first year?
I'm not sure.
Uh-huh.
My guess is that in addition to some of the activities on the waterfront that we've talked about, you also have some in which local people get involved. They threw a watermelon in the government basin and sent in the kids after it, those kinds of things, the type of thing you might associate with a Boy Scout camp water fun day.
In fact, I worked with Jack Toma that year on the contests.
Okay.
And I have a picture of the Mackinac alongside of the dock.
Yeah, Escanaba. No, Mackinac?
The Mackinac.
Mm-hmm.
And the government pond and the contest being run. And I remember that when the contests were over, Jack said to me, "Well, the contests are over, but look at what we got to do. We got to go back over and get all this stuff in to make a presentation to the newspaper." He says, "Come on home and have supper with me." So I went home with him, and I can still remember what we had, because Flora was one of my favorite teachers.
Oh, Flora Tova, yeah,
Flora
Tova. Sure.
And she says, "Jack, you ought to know better than to bring company home." He said, "He isn't company." She says, "You know darn well I told you all you're going to get tonight is hot dogs." He says, "Good enough, isn't it?" I said, "Sure, hot dogs are fine."
What you had.
But it's the first time I ever had a hot dog that was split, that had cheese in it, and wrapped in bacon.
Oh,
yeah.
Sounds good.
And I remember that as though it was last night. To leave it to Flora. She didn't serve me a regular hot dog. No. Jack was quite a guy.
You graduated from high school when?
Which year?
which time?
Well, the thing that amazed me is that you said that Glenn Olson was a teacher when you were in school.
No, he was principal.
He was principal, that was it. Yes,
he came as the principal. He didn't come as a teacher in elementary.
Uh-huh.
But so, he came while you were in high school, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. You graduated several times.
Twice.
Is that in and out of school?
I lack the half a credit.
26 and 27, right?
Yeah, I lack the half a credit.
So
Nisbet cheated me out of a half a credit in English. She was mad at me because I dated the teacher.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah. I had a canoe that had better pickup than a Ford. She thought it was sacrilegious for teachers to go with the student. In fact, they put it in the contract.
No water.
After that, teachers shall not fraternize.
Now, we've got this thing going, and it probably hummed along pretty well, and along came the war. The Escanaba left, which had really been the core of the whole thing, the Escanaba and its crew. And
yes, quite a bit, but by that time we had become pretty well entrenched with the people in Washington, D.C. Over the years, every commandant, with the exception of Richmond, came to Grand Haven. And Richmond never left Washington. He didn't like to travel, and he always sent the vice commandant, or always had flag officers. And Admiral O'Neill, the year that he was here, we rented the castle.
Oh, up on top, Five Mile Hill. Yeah,
and we put all of our guests up there.
Boy.
And in one of the occasions where he had to speak, he said, all of his life as a little boy, he had a dream of someday living in the castle. And he said, I had to come to Grand Haven to have that dream fulfilled.
Isn't that great?
Yeah. He says, I shall never forget.
And what year would that have been?
38? I don't have no idea.
9 or?
These years all end.
Well, it would have been post-World War, though, would it or not?
I don't know. The only way we could tell is to ask Jim Ward to give us a list of the
commandants.
Commandants.
Yeah. O'Brien. Was that his name?
Ward.
Or Jim Ward.
O'Neill.
O'Neill.
The one
who
said it.
Yeah.
He dreamt of living in a castle, came to Grand Haven, and lo and behold.
Yeah. And you know, there weren't many places up there. That thing did set up there just like a castle.
Yeah.
Okay,
well,
I have
a lot of memories of the... And when Jimmy Hirschfield was the district commander in Cleveland, he sent his wife Marge and the two kids, and they lived in the lighthouse dwelling.
Oh, sure.
And in the summer, and he flew in every weekend.
Huh.
And
like Grand Haven.
We put in some long weekends. Jimbo's Island was very active in the early years of the Coast Guard Vessel.
Uh-huh.
He was a reserve officer.
Hmm.
And he was in the Coast Guard Reserve.
Would that be akin to the auxiliary today, or?
Yeah. Uh-huh. One step above that.
Yes.
Yeah. The auxiliary is
civilian.
Civilian and reserve is military.
They could be called into active duty then.
Yes.
At any time. Yeah. Did he serve in the Second World War? I wonder. Jimbo's Island.
I don't know, but he was very active.
Yeah.
And everybody knew him. I mean, in the district, he was everybody in the district.
Yeah. Now you're still talking about the district as District 10.
No, I'm talking about Cleveland.
Oh, okay. Now, that is the ninth.
Nice.
That's the ninth. Okay.
When did that changeover take place, do you think?
shortly after the Escanaba came.
Okay, so that would have been in the 30s that
we
went from many districts in the country to a lesser number.
Yeah, down to the 9th.
They moved the 10th district people to Chicago as an interim, and then it was set up in Cleveland as the 9th.
During the war, we didn't have anything going as far as the Coast Guard Festival is concerned.
Yeah, there was some activity, but nothing like what happened after the war. The loss of the Escanaba and gave it more stability.
Uh-huh. Did it really? It was a rallying point for the community.
Yeah, it was fun before.
Uh-huh.
After the war and the loss of the ship and the dedication of the mast and things like that, it gave it something solid.
Uh-huh.
And when they said that the National Memorial Service will be held in Grand Haven annually, that began to tie things down. So the Grand Haven became the spot.
Uh-huh. Now, you lobbied for that, I assume.
Yeah.
All of you did.
All of us.
But that didn't come about until 70s, 60s, or was it before that?
Well, one of the major things that came about was when Armed Forces Day was established.
Mm-hmm.
And Jerry Ford got up and wanted an exception made for the city of Grand Haven because they had, for a period of years, honored the Coast Guard on their birthday.
Mm-hmm.
And if all armed forces had to be observed on Veterans Day, it would wipe out the connection of the city to the Coast Guard, and he wanted that to be preserved.
Mm-hmm.
And while it was not an act of Congress, as some people say...
Oh, I had always heard that, thought that it was.
Yeah, it was Jerry's interjection.
I think that if we were to research it, we would probably find that within the legislation it says that exceptions can be made for the honoring of any service. This was something that was told to me at one time. In other words, it didn't specifically say Grand Haven. But if there was a festival somewhere that honored the Air Force or one that honored the Navy or one...
Anything of long standing. Could be continued.
You know how legislation is written.
Yes.
In legal terms. Well, in those legal terms, then, Grand Haven fits the mold of a long, ongoing activity that could be perpetuated. And then the next question is, when did they name this Coast Guard City USA? And I think that Dad would share my belief in that in all the visitations of all of these commandants, somewhere down the line, one of them at a dinner after finding the fantastic treatment that they get and the memorial service and all those things, closes his remarks by saying, surely this is Grand Coast Guard City USA.
This is truly Coast Guard City USA.
It'd be nice to know who did that.
Yeah, and then it becomes something that's been repeated and repeated and repeated.
Sure.
And...
I think the one who came the closest to it was Admiral Schmittman when he dedicated the musical fountain 25 years ago. Because
mm-hmm.
he threw the switch.
Uh-huh.
And when he saw that musical fountain, he shook his head. He said, I heard about it. Everyone who has ever been here has come back and extolled the glories of Grand Haven and the way you people have treated the Coast Guard, and you know, as much as says, well, truly this is the Coast Guard City USA.
That's good. Now, of course, you've got that figure, 25 years, so...
Tony Figueroa, who was a skipper on the Woodbine.
Yes.
When he came to Grand Haven and he experienced his first festival, commented that...
Did he follow Joe Fox?
Yeah.
Commented that he had first learned about Coast Guard City, USA, while he was stationed with Coast Guard in London, England. So the reputation of this city for taking good care of the Coast Guard is nationwide. It's worldwide.
Yeah.
And, of course, I guess that was our introduction to the fact that, in fact, the Coast Guard has bases all over the world. They have one in the Mediterranean and other places where they maintain aids to navigation for our vessels.
Yeah, I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah. And so he was stationed in London. And that's where he learned about Grand Haven.
Well, I was in Escanaba this past week, and the Coast Guard were on the program. And the guy from St. Ignace came over after the meeting was over. He said, "You're from Grand Haven." I said, "Yeah." He says, "That is the best Coast Guard town I have ever been to." He said...
Stationed here, was he?
No.
Oh, just knew about it.
He said, "I came in on the Mackinac several times." And he says, "We have been in port in different towns where they did everything but shove a Coast Guard off the sidewalk."
Huh.
And he says, "Then come into Grand Haven and you are welcomed and you're treated like a gentleman."
Uh-huh.
He says... I take my hat off to Grand Haven.
Oh, that's great.
One of the admirals, and this was maybe a year or so ago when I was in Washington with the Chamber Group, made a comment about Grand Haven, and he says "You just can't believe how welcome you will be when you go there." He's telling another individual who is going to be representing the Coast Guard the next year, and he says, "You know," he says, "in our history," he says, "in our experience in the Coast Guard," talking again, two senior officers who've been in there for a while. He says, "We've been in those ports where this sign says, 'Sailors and dogs keep off the grass.'" He said, "You won't see those in Grand Haven."
Where was the famous one was Newport News, someplace out on the East Coast. They said, during the war, dogs and sailors stay off the grass.
He says, "Well, you don't." He says, that's not Grand Haven." He said, he said, "You'll be treated royally."
Yeah. Well, the festival... this 200th coming up is going to be interesting, and I think it's going to be, in a sense, a homecoming for you, because the thing that has so impressed us is the number of reunions that are going to occur, and these things are coming up from out of nowhere. We had no idea that they were going to be as big as the reunions will play as big a part as they're going to, because any ship that these men served on, that is their reunion, and the ship probably doesn't even exist anymore. The SS Stevens or whatever it was, they're having reunions, and putting them up is going to be next to impossible. You're going to have hotel rooms for 60 miles around here, not west, but north, south, east. So I'm sure you're going to enjoy it. We all will, of course, to the history involved.
Well, and you know, some of those reunions carry through one, two, three ships. In some cases, if you have an Escanaba reunion, it can be the first, the second, or the third.
Oh, I see.
If I understand it correctly.
True. Yeah, that's right. Of course, we're on our third.
Yeah. Yeah. And there are, of course, several others, because it was at Tahoma that is also a famous class cutter. So there's at least one other, if not two others.
Mm-hmm.
So,
This whole thing is going to kick off in August of this coming year, or of this year, I should say, 89, out in Newburyport, Connecticut, or Massachusetts, Newburyport, Massachusetts, where the first ship was launched. And then they'll pass the torch to us. The finale of the whole thing will be a year from this summer.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you, as mayor... You had to have a lot to do with the festival and the parade.
Hey, the festival followed me.
What do you mean?
You know what I mean?
No. Oh, it followed you. What?
Well, when I was on the city council,
yeah,
even before I became mayor, I was the one who had the most interest on the part of the city.
Uh-huh.
I was most active. It was a city function.
Uh-huh.
When I went down to the Chamber of Commerce,
oh, of course,
it became pretty much a Chamber of Commerce.
That's right, exactly.
For 15 years.
Sure.
And so.
So it has been passed from your dad's fishing experiences to you. Interesting.
Like from the city to the Chamber.
That's right. Yeah.
I had a hand in it for many, many years.
Yeah, you sure did.
And I'm still interested.
Uh-huh.
I'm still an advisor to the committee.
Tell me this. Glenn isn't here. I'm sorry. Wasn't here. But where did the boot camp... tell me about the boot camp in Mulligan's Hollow.
Well, that was set up during the war.
Okay.
And we had two vessels here for training. And,
of course, that was originally a civil conservation corps camp.
Yeah.
Well, that's when Glenn was here, isn't it?
That's when Glenn...
That's right.
That's what brought
Thank
Glenn
you.
Here.
Yeah. CCC.
Yeah. CCC.
Uh-huh.
And the camp was there, and they converted it into a Coast Guard training camp.
So that would have been... Glenn came here then in the early 30s, didn't he?
Yeah. And the top man then was Disberry.
Hmm.
Lieutenant Disberry was the top man around here.
I think he probably, you know, within the private collections in the community of movies and things, I think you probably would find that there are some pictures of large Coast Guard contingents marching down Washington Street. Now, I seem to recall having seen those. I wonder if during World War II, there wasn't some, you know...
Oh, hell, there was a festival.
Yeah.
Sure.
And you see, they could involve, at this point, the boot camp trainees, you know, get them out and march them down the street.
And then they had...
And that's not a bad thing to do in a major war, to, you know, it's a patriotic thing. Everybody comes out and recognizes the people that are on their way to fight the war.
Mm-hmm. And what do you call a place where they set up for them to... it was downtown in... I always refer to it as the Jurgensen building because they built it. But
I know what you mean.
What do they call those where they set them up? Mrs. Gale. Mrs. Doc Gale.
USO.
USO.
Oh, okay. Good heavens.
Yeah,
we had our own USO here.
Sure, we had a USO. Now, what is well, the Busy Bee shoe store just moved out a part of that building.
Okay.
And that that building there was the USO.
Sure, Jurgensen's had the filling station out in front. Or a gas pump, anyway.
The gas pump.
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that was the USO. And Mrs. Doc Gale was the lady in charge of the USO.
Huh. How many men would be here in training? A couple hundred?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And then as soon as they completed their boot training?
Away they went.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. And it's even conceivable there was more than one group at a time, you know, may have staggered a couple hundred at least. There was a lot of barracks over there.
Yeah.
It's worth researching a little because, you know, my recollection of the camp after...
Probably in your mind, it was big.
Well, yeah, I turned over to the city. I know that my explorer folks had one of those buildings. And, you know, thinking in terms of how many people, we just had a father and son overnight for Boy Scouts, and we had 40 people in a pretty small building. And, well, these had bunk beds lined up. I have to believe that those bunk houses, I don't know what they could have held. They could have held an awful lot of men.
Well,
and they had a headquarters building, and they had a laundry, and the laundry is now the Coast Guard, or is now the Ski Bowl building.
Oh, is it?
Uh-huh. Yeah, but the hospital was the flat top building out there.
Yeah.
That was the newest building that was built. That was the...
But they're all gone now, with the exception of that one.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You see, that building was suitable for the niche because it was the only one with a concrete floor in it.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, and there was a lot of drainage that had to be...
What did they do with the hospital building?
Well, that was one of the last ones, and they had a caretaker who lived in there for a while.
He lived in there a long time.
And, you know, in other words, it was a city employee who was given the use of that building to live in for his kind of watching over things.
Mm-hmm.
The buildings were made available to any civic group. The JCs started, the first time they had a building, they were out there. The Odd Fellows were there. I know... My Explorer Post, which was sponsored by First Presbyterian, was there.
That was
the Coast Guard had a pistol range in one of the buildings.
That was during my administration.
Yeah.
Because they were going to tear all the buildings down. And I said, wait a minute. With the unsettled condition, you may need them again. They said, well, we can't maintain them. I said, we'll maintain them. How are you going to do it? I said, we'll make them available to different organizations with the understanding that they maintain them.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we did.
And admittedly, some of them did start, you know, those that weren't being used did start to fall into disrepair.
And we...
And the city saw stored their salt over there and he took the side out of a building and put salt in there.
So,
you know, so that properties, which originally had, if I remember, been a farm for the Mulligan family...
Mulligan's Hollow.
Yeah, turned into a CCC camp, and then a Coast Guard camp, and then served the city in various ways, and let's face it, now it's a recreation park.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and well used.
Fantastic sport.
That ski area is great for kids. Hugh Mulligan, you must have known Hugh.
Oh, yeah.
That was his family who the Hollow was named for.
Could very well have been. I never actually knew whether there was a tie-in or not, because Hugh lived on Slayton Street, and I never had occasion to ask him if that was a connection.
Yeah, close enough, though.
He was in the Steamboat Inspection Service,
mm-hmm.
up in the post office.
Mm-hmm. The federal building.
Federal building.
Wasn't that what it was called?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the federal building,
yeah.
You bet.
You know, looking back, two other people that were involved, Cap Wessel, that would be Don Wessel's
yes.
father, uh-huh. was with the Coast Guard.
He was second in command.
Yeah, here in the post office where Old Camp Bank is now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was second in command.
Many colorful people. Served in many positions in this community, you know.
But in the early days, Rotary was involved, Kiwanis,
mm-hmm.
In the early festivals.
Have float.
Well, other than that, Rotary, Henry Wieringa was active
for
a couple of years.
Jim's dad.
Then they had golf tournaments, and the JCs or Kiwanis. Kiwanis would be the age group that worked the golf tournaments for a while. And a lot of people have been involved over the years. And then we were criticized because there wasn't enough for the young ones. And we got those rolling. Then we were criticized there wasn't enough for the high school age. So we put the street dance on downtown.
And, oh, yes.
We had that for a couple of years. Then they began breaking storefront windows and fights and everything. We had to discontinue that. God, if a guy had only written a book, a chapter for each year, I don't know who would have bought it, but it would have made some fascinating.
That's still a problem today, by the way, of what we can do. And we ask all the time, what can we do for the youth that they will appreciate? you know, and won't be totally disruptive. Mm-hmm. And it's a question we still have not answered. We keep trying things.
Well, it's like trying to keep up with a fad.
I think you're
it's
right.
It's elusive.
Yes, it is.
Never catch it.
And then we have the year that we never mentioned, the year of the scandal.
Uh-oh. Can this be on the tape?
Oh, no. No way. It's interesting, but it's not on tape.
It's a recent, in recent years?
No.
Oh, I see.
It's,
okay.
Prior to the loss of the Esplanade.
Oh, I see. Okay. All right.
Obviously, the loss of the Escanabo has to be a rallying point for the festival.
Uh-huh.
Festivals come and festivals go. That, you know, these people were known to the people of this community. Families lived here. The fact that they were able to subscribe enough money to build another Escanaba in this community within a matter of what? How long?
60 days.
Kind of a test of kinship that people feel in this community for the Coast Guard at that
point. 1,300,000.
Yeah.
And so those, that certainly then became another reason to continue this. And in
fact,
in this report we referenced before, which gives historical things, they're beyond the historical. We go on in here, and in one paragraph, I think maybe it tells at least where we're coming from. We see the festival from differing viewpoints ourselves. Many of us are involved in the festival operations because of its obvious intent to honor the nation's oldest seagoing branch of the military. Not only is the National Memorial Service held in Grand Haven each year during Festival Week, but there are a number of other events which specifically are intended to honor our past, current and former Coast Guardsmen, like the annual retiree get-together.
Mm-hmm.
I guess that, you know, if you had to say to me, why do you work on the Coast Guard Festival? If that's the reason.
Mm-hmm.
It's because of the historical knowledge that I have of it. It's the respect I have for the service. You know, it's all of that. You know, I don't know. Parades, carnivals, and other things I can do without.
Mm-hmm.
Dad has made the comment. He said, if I ever get to the point where I can't participate in a lot of activities, the last two I'll give up, okay, are the memorial service and the retirees party.
Oh.
I mean, those are... No, the memorial service, when it comes right down, that's the last. That is the highlight of the festival.
Yes.
To a lot of us.
Uh-huh.
You know, that brings a tear to your eye when you sit there and you listen to that memorial service.
Mm-hmm.
And you think about what it represents.
Mm-hmm.
That's important. It's the most important part of the festival.
It's given O'Malley a reason for living, hasn't it? Boy. He really epitomizes what we're talking about.
Yes.
There.
Yes.
And this really didn't come about until after the war, after the Escanaba was sunk.
Yeah.
That really is where...
That began to give it substance.
Yeah. Uh-huh, yeah.
Before that, it was playtime.
Yeah. And it was... And the water festival phase of it then was pretty much gone after the war,
well,
wasn't it?
Well, it's time marches on.
Uh-huh.
Helicopters came in, you didn't need breeches buoys, you
uh-huh.
didn't shoot a line, you dropped the line.
Mm-hmm.
Pulling boats, they're out. Power boats, we've mm-hmm. got. Helicopters again. You know?
Yeah, sure.
All of that stuff became obsolete. Why do we have to go out and pull a boat and capsize it? You don't use the boats anymore.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So all of that stuff that was the basis for spectacular waterfront activities.
Mm-hmm.
Those are all museum pieces.
Mm-hmm.
Let's face it, I think it was 38 that the J.R. Zanzibar was towed from South Chicago to Johnson Boiler to be re-outfitted with new boilers. And it was brought in here by a couple of big, heavy Chicago river tugs. And they met was some heavy breezes out here, and they had to put the Zanzibar at anchor and come in and get coal. And then they couldn't get back out because the seas had picked up instead of moderating. They picked up.
We've got all this on film.
This is all on film. And the Zanzibar broke anchor and went aground by Rosie Mount. We have movies of the Bridges buoy being shot to the Zanzibar.
The last time it was used on the Great Lakes.
Now, who took these films?
I took some.
Uh-huh.
O.T. Gillick took some.
Okay, your father-in-law.
Yeah. And so we have this film. It shows the tugs coming into the harbor and a telephoto of the ship setting at anchor. It shows them trying to get back out. And like I said, by this time the seas were really running heavy. Great big deep draft harbor tugs. And when you can see one of these coming up on a comber, and
you can look under, you can look under it all the way to the boiler room.
And then when she dipped down in, it would practically disappear.
Uh-huh.
Well, then, of course, there's some interesting footage there of them skillfully
backing up.
Oh, they didn't quite come around.
No, allowing them to back up quite a ways before they finally
swung.
Uh-huh. And you can see the smoke and steam belching out of the stack when they gave her full power to turn her around.
They wanted to do it in a hurry.
In a hurry, or go over with it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, like we say, there's a point at which you leave the waterfront for some of the types of activities you had in the past.
What year would that have been?
38?
I think it's 38. We could look
uh-huh.
that up.
Yeah.
As I say, we have that on film.
Uh-huh.
Huh. Of course, you know, He was going to be the smart guy, so he figures there'll probably be a lawsuit about here, you know, and so he's taking these pictures, and he takes a job cooking on one of the tugs that was doing the towing to pull it off the beach. And they pulled it off the beach in the middle of the night, so he couldn't get pictures of that.
Is that right?
That damn crew. They had to get the pictures, and they tripped me out. Pull it off in the middle of the night.
And then the other probably interesting part is that the knowledge that...
Yeah.
Can Bob be spared a minute?
Yeah.
Sure. We're about through.
The knowledge that the film existed settled the lawsuit. He never got paid.
Is that right?
Yeah. Both sides were bidding for the film. They finally settled it and I got shit.
Isn't that something, though? So you had suspected that.
Sure.
Yeah, sure.
I could see...
Yeah. That is something.
It's an interesting film.
Yeah.
Damn, I took it over and showed it to the licensed tugman annual meeting in Chicago. And, boy, I got a standing ovation. And
you narrated it as it went.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, you ought to put that on videotape. Let's make an effort to do that. And put a voice on with it.
And when we got it rewound, the guy in the back says, run it again. Yeah. Well, we don't see something like this very often. I had it run it the second time.
Isn't that something, though?
Yeah.
How long does it take? 3 minutes, 4 minutes, or longer than that?
12, 14 minutes.
That's all. Mm-hmm. But it's footage that's mm-hmm. invaluable.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I'm going to run. This has been good. We'll do it again. You know, I would like to sometime just go on the fishing industry.
Oh.
And bring it right up to the current tide.
That's my point.
Okay. Thanks, Bob.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to sign off here. Phones are... Bob is being taken away by business, and the phone's ringing for Claude. We had hoped we could have Glenn Eaton on this tape, but it didn't work out. Glenn had thought that the meeting was at 10 o'clock and we started at 9 o'clock. So we'll sign off at this point. We'll catch Claude, who has much more information, as you can tell from hearing this tape, about other matters concerning the city. And we'll catch him another time. So here it is.